This is an encore presentation of Unreserved. Enjoy.
Okay, so what is an elder? That is a question I think that many people have tried to answer. They're highly knowledgeable. They're older. There's not really an age, though. Not really. And then the other requirement, I think, is that that they're sharing the knowledge.
We have elders who specialize in, could be spirituality. So we have elders that you go to for those questions about spirituality. You may have elders who specialize in historical accounts, storytelling. You go to those elders for that expertise. So every elder has something that they specialize in. And so we know in our community, who do I go to if I need an answer on how to heal my mind? Then I have somebody I might go to, how do I heal my heart? I might go to another elder, how do I heal my spirit?
You don't just become an elder overnight. Nobody can declare you an elder. It's like a lived experience. And it takes a long time, of course, you know, because you know, you have to live the life, you have to know the ways.
Danse, Anine, Bonjour, hello and welcome. This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Indigenous elders hold an important role in our community circles. They teach us language, share songs and stories. They carry and pass on cultural history and knowledge to the next generation. You just heard a few of those wise voices. They were featured in a special project by CBC New Brunswick. Six elders from Mi'kmaq, Wolastoqiyik, and Passamaquoddy communities share their personal stories about their life, the work they do, and the change it brings. And while they have ties that bind them, they each take a unique approach to the role of elder. Today on Radio Indigenous, we invite you to sit and learn with us in the Elders Circle. Cecilia Brooks really walks her talk. I mean, literally. This elder from St. Mary's First Nation owns a medicine walk business called Wabanaki Tree Spirit. She and her son Anthony designed the medicine walk for people who want to connect with and understand Indigenous people better. Brooks, who is Wolastoqiyik, Mi'kmaq, Mohawk, and Korean, specializes in native plants and foods. If you sign up for one of Cecilia's walks, you'll likely begin in Fredericton's Odell Park, surrounded by 500-year-old hemlock trees. Cecilia will teach you about the traditional uses of plants you come across. Then she'll bring out her conifer tea and tell you how it was used to treat Jacques Cartier's crew members suffering from scurvy when they arrived in the 1500s. Just a little something she came across in a journal of ethnobotany. You might say she spills the tea on history. It's all in a day's work for this science-knowing elder.
Look at this. The pine tree. That's one of the things that I think we forget about are the trees as medicine, right? And trees as food.
So we're in Odell Park. And this is where my son Anthony and I, we come here with, we call them the walkers, and they'll come and sign up for a medicine walk. So we take people on little groups, you know, maybe 10 people, and we walk them through the forest and teach them about the medicinal plants and some of the food plants. As you see around here, there's a lot of trout lilies, and that's one of the food plants. My whole life, I've always had a relationship with plants. My first teacher would have been my mother. I guess she must have learned from her mother as well and other people in her life. And her friends, they would teach me. So we would go out foraging. My dad was in the military, and so we lived in other countries. And we always went to the woods, especially this time of year, because my mom always said, oh, there's so much to eat out there in the springtime because the little greens that are coming up, and we go pick them and bring them home and make a nice salad out of them. Yeah, so my mom, and then I never took a botany course. I have a chemistry degree with a biology minor, But I never took botany, I guess because I thought I was going to go to med school, so I thought animal science is more important. But then I took my first botany course with my son Anthony when he got disenchanted with university. And I said, what do you want to do? And he said, well, I'd like to learn more about what you do. And so we took a course together. Look at the needles, right? And it's a white pine. See that? This is a white pine. And the reason we know that, we're going to use the English language here, W-H-I-T-E. And you know, I think there's a saying, knowledge is power, right? And that's a nice idea, and it is true. Knowledge is power. But if knowledge isn't shared, it's sort of like a story, right? If it's not shared, then it's gone. It doesn't get passed along. And our tradition is to pass that knowledge on, so that our people, and we say our people, I don't mean just, you know, my children. We mean all people, humans, all humans, so that they can carry on and they can take care of themselves in a way that's, you know, in harmony with nature. And so, yeah, I want to pass that knowledge on. I want to share it with as many people as we can share it with. So what is an elder? That's a question that we have talked about a lot, you know, in our talking circles about how do you identify an elder? What, you know, what are the traits? And so some of the things that the elders that I've talked to say is that, you know, they said, one, watch out for the people who say, I'm an elder. So you don't self-identify as an elder. It's a title, I think, that is bestowed upon you by your community. So when the community begins to call you an elder, then you're beginning to enter into elderhood. And that's been happening to me lately. And at first, I have to admit, it's a little bit, I won't say uncomfortable, it's just kind of odd. It's like a new title, and you're very cautious because it's an honorable title that you don't want to in any way tarnish. So once you have that title, then you have to, you know, be mindful of how you're conducting yourself and make sure that you are thinking about the youth and the other people in the community and sharing that information. That's another piece that I think is very important, because we have people who have knowledge, and I kind of make a parallel between in the academic world, because I work in the academic world, and you see PhDs, and they're experts, right? They're experts. And we have experts too. We call them elders. But the difference is, I think, you know, in the university, you have some professors who have knowledge, who really just stay in their research, and they never share, really, like in a way with the young people. They may publish and people can find their work, but it's not like a sharing. So this is different. So the elders, I think, it's a requirement. You have to share and pass on that knowledge for the survival of the future generations. And then, of course, you've got your birches and all the birches. Folks may not know this, but the birch leaves are very, very mild, and they make an excellent tea. So I collect the birch, and you can get any of the birch leaves, and you can mix that with you know, mint or whatever. And some leaves on trees like maple, oh yuck, don't even try it, it's very, very bitter. But the birch is super mild, and it blends well with others, and of course it's you know, medicinal, because it has the betulinic acid in it, just like chaga does. People on the walk, I think mostly they're grateful to learn, and they're also sometimes surprised at all the things that are around them, because they never think about, oh well, you know, let's go make a tea out of a fir tree or out of leaves from a birch tree. But yeah, they're usually surprised. And then of course, when we talk about the culture and the history, they're also very grateful to learn that, especially now with all these discoveries of what I think in our, not think, but I know that in our communities we've known, because our survivors, the residential school survivors, have told us that to be, you know, that there are bodies out there, that there are children that were not accounted for. And so now it's all coming to light, and it's sad news, but I'm glad that it's finally coming to this, and that we're finally going to find the bodies and bring them home so that they can come back to their families.
I was listening to Anthony and David yesterday, and we were making supper, and David says, yeah, you know, all this is happening. And he said, it's no wonder that Grandpa, my dad, was so angry with me for wanting to come to Canada, because he left Canada a long time ago. And when I told him that I was moving as a single mother with my two young men, young boys at the time, to Canada, he was mad. Oh, he was mad. He says, you are making a mistake. You have a good job. You have good, you know, future, your career. And when his words, he said, there's not a goddamn thing there for Indians. And there never will be. Yeah. Oh, he was very upset. But, you know, I showed him. I had to show him. I said, I have to go, Dad. I have to go. Because, you know, and I told him why. I had a spiritual leader in Kingsclear Wimpy, Charles Solomon, and he was the one who told me. He said, come. He said, we need you here. And so I packed it all up, quit my job, and I had saved a little money, and we came. And after I'd been here for 5 or 6 years, and Dad saw the changes that were happening. So he got to see that before he passed away. And that was my goal, was to show him that people can change and things can change, and we're changing it.
Cecilia Brooks is an elder from St. Mary's First Nation and the first elder that we'll be meeting today. She's Wolastoqe, Mi'kmaq, Mohawk, and Korean, and owns Wabanaki Tree Spirit with her son Anthony. This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Coming up. Years ago, George Paul was told he had a song to sing, and it became an anthem for his people. But first, in the past 2 decades, Imelda Purley has given Wolastoqe names to more than 200 children. The elder from Ngokuk, or Tobik First Nation, finds their names through ceremony and prayer. Her passion for returning traditional names is rooted in her own loss. Imelda's grandmother named her a Blossomwees, which means Moon of the Whirling Wind. Catholic Day School took that name away. But a Blossomwees would reclaim her Wolastoqe name thanks to some good advice and an astonishing experience at a ceremony.
We went to Garden River in Ontario, and I fasted for the first time in 1994. That was... oh my goodness, that's the time I got my name back. Because, see, I was called a Blossom was as a child, but not being able to use it in the school, in the playground, in my own community, I'd forgotten it. And so they were doing a ceremony at the time. There were about 30-some people from around the world that had come to this elder, Elder Suwen. And everybody was coming to her for answers, for guidance. And some people were fasting one day, some people were fasting two, some people were fasting four, some people more. I was there to do my first four, but I got my vision after 2 days. And I remember there was this long line of people lined up to the elder asking for spirit names. And I'm going, I don't want an Ojibwe spirit name. I'm Wolastoqe or Maliseet, and I'm going to have to go back to my elder because I want a spirit name in my own language. But I was the only one that wasn't in line, and the helpers were there. At least go stand in line. Respect the elder. I said, okay. So I went there, and I'm standing there with my doubting Thomas mind. And I remember holding my tobacco to give to him, the elders. It's called the shaking tent ceremony. And I'm thinking Wizard of Oz, because as I'm standing in line and each person is going, and you don't see the elder because, you know, the tent has a door on it, but he speaks to you through this thing. And his gift is he has an open door policy to the spiritual, so he talks to ancestors. So I'm thinking, yeah, okay, sure. You know, it was my first fast. But I heard wind, I heard storms, I heard ocean, I heard rain, I heard animal calls, etc. And I was just really thinking, Wizard of Oz, he probably has, that's why he's not showing himself. But you know, when it was my turn, he said, "You don't believe, do you?" I said, "It's my first fast, and I'm Maliseet, and I'm not Ojibwe, so I don't really want an Ojibwe name." And then he goes, "Well, you already have a name." And my grandmother's voice came through him, and she had already passed away so many years. That's when I trusted. That's when I believed. And that's when I knew a blossom was means something more than Imelda does. And I went, got really emotional, got all the hugs from all the clan mothers, and they said, "Your grandmother gifted you that name, and that just because she's in this bureau doesn't mean you don't get to connect with her." And so that's been my guiding light, you know, ever since. And so now it's important for me to do those naming ceremonies because of what happened to me. Because I went so long without mine that there was a void.
Okay, so what I want to do with all of you that got your spirit notes today, I want you to stand this way, and I'm going to light my pipe, and then I'm going to bless you from behind for carrying the name, okay?
Just this morning at the school, because I recently named these seven children, and this morning the grade four boys come in and he goes, "A blossom was, can you teach me how to say my spirit name? Because it's in the language, you know." And so I explained him. So I spent a good half hour with them. "This is what your name means. This is how it's pronounced. This is why, this is your job now to do this. Because your spirit name is reminding you. You have something, you were sent here for a reason. And Creator gave you a responsibility. And your spirit will guide you to that responsibility. Your English name, that'll guide you too. But when your English name doesn't work for you, you always have your spirit name to guide you to make sure that you're a good human."
So Stone's spirit name is Bunupsqueedon. He already is named Stone, but he needs the Wolastoqe name Stone. Agweedon is Gluskubs, Gelwiskubs, Stone Canoe. One who keeps our traditions for each generation. So it's that Gluskub Stone Canoe. So his spirit is that Stone Canoe that we have. So it's a really strong name. And so he's going to carry our traditions in that Stone Canoe and stuff. So, and the Stone Canoe never sank because it can be light as a feather or heavy if it needed to be. So that's your strength. So sometimes you're going to need light strength, sometimes you're going to need heavy strength. And so that's the strength that you have to carry from now for the rest of your life. Because congratulations and stuff. So everybody, can you say it? Bunupsqueedon?
Bunupsqueedon.
That's his spirit name today, Wiliwin. So now what we're going to do is all the ones that got their spirit names, circle the fire, you're going to offer the blueberries. And then I'm going to do a pipe to finalize, and then we're all going to sing a song, an honor song, for all of you that got your name today.
When you're a physical person, you might have issues in a classroom or issues at home or issues in a relationship. But when you do something spiritual, it softens you. And so that's why we always say, yes, feed your body. But don't forget to feed your spirit, because it's your spirit that's going to be your guiding point. There's going to be times when you're angry, but that's when you call on your spirit name to teach you how to overcome this anger. You know, it's nothing wrong with being angry. It's part of being human. But you can't stay angry. And so you need spirit to help you how to use that anger in a positive way, and so that you don't hurt yourself or anybody.
Eskimodamus and Egnigam in Jossin. Put a leaskiach Wabinito. Ola bin again, a mid again. Delbe dowsin. Eskimo moose, a negnege say yasin. Boodleeski. Lijasi. Don was the day born, it by do. Hinto Kanama seed Elijah dim Del Bedowsin Eskimo Moose of Negnegam in Drossin Eskimo Moose of Negnegam in Drossin Eskimo Moose of Negnegam in Drossin.
That was Emma Stevens with a beautiful cover of the song Blackbird, sung entirely in Mi'kmaq. The Nova Scotia teen was just 16 years old when she recorded the Beatles classic in 2019. You're listening to Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Today we're joining six elders from the east coast of Turtle Island, learning about the many roles they play in our communities. Still ahead, we meet a Passamaquoddy elder whose whole job is to preserve and restore the stories and traditions of his people. But what happens when he gets a call to restore audio recordings from wax cylinders? Find out in just a few minutes. But first, I want to introduce you to George Paul. The Mi'kmaq elder from Medabinagiug specializes in picking herbal medicines and outdoor survival. If that's not cool enough, he's also well known for another reason. George Paul created the Mi'kmaq Honor Song. The song is popular at powwows for grand entries and to honor individuals. Paul has shared this song with Wolastoqiyik and Cree communities and gave permission for it to be translated into their languages. But his journey began in the 1970s. It would lead him along the powwow trail to one of the biggest, held in Regina. That's where George heard the first beats of his own song. And it began with a lament.
There were so many Native people there from all over, and they were out there from all over. And they had about 1,000 teepees set up in Regina, Saskatchewan. They're out in the fields. And they had a powwow there. And at that powwow, I saw all these dancers come in. Some of the elders, you know, they were about 100 years old at least, or nearing 100, because they were escorted in and their faces had maps on them that, you know, they were aged. And on down to, you know, they had eagle feathers all the way down to their heels, and from all different tribes. And then all the different dancers and the categories of dancers after that. The grand entry was about a half a mile long, because there was so many people. There was probably about 3,000 dancers dancing in, so many of them. And there was all categories of men, women, and children. And as I was watching them dance, I could feel the power of that that grand entry of them dancing in. It was like watching the ancestors come dancing, because they were dressed in their traditional regalia, and you couldn't tell if they were, you know, from ancient times or what. I mean, like, you know, it was right there. And it was so awesome, you know, to see that. They had like 42 drums to do the grand entry, because there was so many people dancing in. They just took turns one after the other, because one drum couldn't do it all. They're just one right after the other. When I saw the kids dancing in, they were like 5-6-year-old kids. That's what brought tears to my eyes, you know, because I wanted that for my people, right? And why weren't my people doing that? What was the shame? Why did they not want to do that? Were they shamed that bad, or was it outlawed, or what? I was trying to understand what was going on. Why was that? And it hurt. My heart was just like I was crying. You know? I was just like, you know, my tears run down. And I had a friend that went with me on that journey there, and I didn't want him to see me crying, so I was like trying to be stoic and everything. But tears were running down my face when I saw that, right? Because I want to see that for our people, you know. And so now I'm reflecting on these things while I'm fasting there in the Kootenai Plains, right? And I'm thinking about that. When I got to the base of that mountain, and when I'm walking down the mountain, down, all of that came to me, and it hit me again. And I started crying. And I couldn't stop crying. I was just crying and just wailing because I thought about my people back home, who were, a lot of them were, you know, in a drunken stupor. Maybe there was alcoholism in communities, and people didn't know how to get out of it. And there was no help for them back in those times and stuff, you know. And I felt so sad for our people, you know, and the pride that these people had here. They had everything. They could still do all. The kids knew their dances to every step, you know, and I think about my people back home. They didn't even know a chant, what a chant was. You know, they didn't know anything about their history, kind of forgotten about it, kind of almost assimilated. So, you know, I was crying over that, and I cried, and I cried so much I couldn't cry anymore until I was just wailing. It was just dry wailing, but it was, the pain was still there, and I was just wailing, right? I didn't realize it till later on that, you know, what was happening to me. I was in a lament. I was lamenting for something that you have lost, like a dear one, or like our people, right, we're losing our culture, losing who we are. So I made a commitment. I said, I'm going to go back home, and when I go back home, I'm going to do everything I can to try to help. Because I asked myself a question, what do I have? What can I do to help my people? I don't have anything. I don't have money or position or power or anything. Who's going to listen to me? And so the elder, first of all, told me when I went into the sweat after I finished my fast there, he said, you have a song to sing. And I didn't really know what he was talking about then. He said, well, it'll come to you whenever. A year later, a blind man comes from Shubenacadie, Mi'kmaq man, and he wants to learn about the sweat lodge ceremony and the pipe and stuff. And he went over to an elder in the ground there, and they called me over to help participate. And I was sitting in the sweat with him, and during one of the rounds, he said, George, he said, you have a song to sing. You have to sing that song for your people. And it reminded me of everything. It's all come together now. It's all hitting me right here now. I said, yes. But what it seemed like he was saying, it's like you have a message to deliver. You have to deliver the message to your people. And so that I thought just for a few seconds there, and the words come just right with that, you know, because I was thinking of myself crying that time, right? So that's, the song comes to me like this here. Give me day the minish dandelion no dig. Let us honor the people that we are. Nigamaj dud mawidanish, my people, let us come together. Give me day the minish dan wedebeksuk dig. Let us honor our ancestry, our bloodlines. Nigamaj dud abahomarutnish, my people, let us help one another. Abahomarutnish dangisuk teligao sigol sitham. Let's help one another in the manner that the Creator has placed us here upon Mother Earth. And the rest is the chant, and the chant is from my emotion, my crying, right? That feeling that I had there. Much good, my wee.
George Paul is a Mi'kmaq elder from Medabinagiag. He composed the Mi'kmaq Honor Song. This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Not an elder, but definitely a favorite cousin. Donald Saktoma returns lost history back to his people. As the Tribal Historic Preservation Officer for the Passamaquoddy Tribe, Donald works with both the U.S. and Canadian governments to protect culturally significant sites, artifacts, and knowledge. It's work he's very passionate about. For the past several years, Saktoma has been working to translate some very early audio recordings of Passamaquoddy songs. They were recorded on wax cylinders, which were invented way back in 1880 to use with phonographs, so pretty old. There were mountains of cylinders in government archives, but most of them were unlabeled. The owners of those voices and stories were a mystery. And that's where Donald and a group of Passamaquoddy elders come in.
In the early 70s, the government decided to try to index all the wax cylinders they had. And they had thousands and thousands of wax cylinders. And a lot of them didn't have the notebook that would say which native group was speaking or what the title of the story is or the title of the song. So the Library of Congress eventually took over that project, and they reached out to all the tribes, all the communities, to see who recognizes the language. They approached us in 1990. They gave us cassette recordings of the raw data from the wax cylinders. Now, wax cylinders are one of the earliest forms of recordings, and it happened to come that in 1890, the oldest field recording was done along the St. Croix River with the community of Passamaquoddy. So this, they got all excited about. They were able to find out eventually that who recorded this and the date. So they gave us the raw data, and our fluent speakers tried to transcribe a lot of the songs, but because it was directly off the cylinders, it's a lot of scratching and it's hard to understand. They transcribed a couple of the cylinders. Each cylinder can hold 2 to 3 minutes of recording, and we had 31 cylinders. The rest of the cylinders, they weren't able to understand because of the scratching. So 2010, the Library of Congress approaches me, and they have new technology that removes the scratches from the background. So we started up again, and this time I have a team of fluent speakers and fluent writers in our language. And we've got about 28 done right now, and it's a long process. We have the transcribers write in Passamaquoddy what the words are and translated into English. And then I take it to a team of elderly community members and play the recording for them to make sure that what's being transcribed is correct from their viewpoint. Because it's only 2 minutes, 2 to 3 minutes, like a song, there's not many of our songs that are 2 or 3 minutes. So we try to find links from that song to longer songs. And a couple of the cylinders had stories of the traveling from community to community, stories of hunting, stories of some of the creatures from the past, like the Thunderbird. So we're learning these old stories that, you know, over time have sort of stepped away, but now they're coming back. And our children in the community, especially the drummers and the singers, are excited about this because they want to play them for our ceremonial days. The first one that we completed, we took it to our grammar school, and we had the kids stand in a circle, and one of our singers sang the song and explained it. So kids were pretty impressed with that work that's been done, the knowledge that's out there. So when they go to the public school, you know, they can explain our history. There was a lot of oppression going on in our community, and the outside world tried everything they could to take our culture and traditions away. But our community still hung on to some of our songs that we currently sing. But the Wax Cylinder project has brought a new wave of more material to sing, and it gets the children wondering and asking a lot of questions of why this song was sung, what it's for, and learning the language. Sometimes I don't have any words for how happy I feel, especially when I see something go full circle like these wax cylinders, and I see those children singing the songs that were made in 1890 by probably their great-great-grandfather or grandmother. That's really rewarding, and it's so powerful that we're able to do that. I'd like to say Upchich Nimiol Ba. That means until we meet again.
Jeremy Dutcher, a member of Tobik First Nation in New Brunswick. He also discovered the voices of his ancestors on wax cylinders and created the album Listigwayik Linta Waginawa. You're listening to Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Today, the voices of our elders. Noel Millier sees healing as a journey that never ends. He has devoted 40 years of his life to helping people heal from alcoholism, trauma, and systemic racism. Noel's own healing journey began in his 20s when he got sober. Since then, he's helped hundreds of people find their way out of addiction. One of his proudest moments was helping to get an addiction treatment center built in Elsibuktuk First Nation, because Noel says culture is a source of healing.
I'm a recovering alcoholic myself. My work with healing work is part of my recovery. It all began with me wanting to give back a little bit to my community because of all of the times of my dysfunction and stuff. I always felt that I was taking away from the community. And so part of my sense of recovery was to be able to give back to the community. So another opportunity presented itself to me to be able to do a little bit of work that I was very familiar with, and that was the world of addictions. So I became an addictions worker in the community. So I started that work, and as I was working in the addictions field, I had a very beautiful and very wise mentor that helped us, because we started to find out in our community that there was a need for a treatment center. And so we started looking at the possibilities of this, and the band was very, our band council at the time was very proactive in that, and they were very supportive of that. So we sent in a proposal and it was approved, and so we got allocated a treatment center. And so when we were building this treatment center, we were developing a program, and we wanted this program to be kind of like unique. We wanted to incorporate a cultural-based program, something that was based on our own culture that we could help our people to be able to heal from. Because it's one thing to stop drinking, it's another thing to be able to begin healing. So those are two very distinct ones. So we wanted to use our culture as a modality for people to be able to work on themselves a little bit. And so we came up with this idea way back when our community was predominantly Roman Catholic, and it was very well entrenched within everything that there was within the community. And we didn't want to go against that because it was important that we had the support from the elders in the community, both the, we'll say, the cultural people and the traditional Roman Catholic elders. So it was very important that we were able to do this. And so we said, we were thinking, how can we do this? And so we started looking around for people that will be able to help us. And up in Manitoulin Island, we found a priest. It was an Ojibwe priest, a native priest. And he incorporated part of his ceremonial customs into the mass that he did. And so we asked him to come down and to help us with this transition that we were going through. And so he came into the community and slowly started integrating the smudging ceremony in the mass and the drumming in the mass. He introduced the pipe, and he did this during mass with all of the community elders and the community people there, just to let them know that it's not really about one or another, but it more so about honoring both and integrating both to make something very strong within them. And so he did that. And the priest's name was Father John Haskell. And he was really an amazing man. And so he did a lot of this groundwork for us, and so we started developing a cultural-based model of treatment for our people. And we wanted to honor this priest in a good way. And his spiritual name was Lone Eagle. And so we said, we're going to name the treatment center after him. And so we named the treatment center the Lone Eagle Treatment Center. And it's still operating today, which is really beautiful. You can't stop healing. And you can't stop reflecting on life's journey and the meaning of the life's journey. And to be able to heal from some of these past systemic traumas that we carry around. We're never finished our journey of healing. And we always learn. I learn from a lot of people who will say, who consider me their elder. I always learn things from them. Sometimes those are my best teachers, are my students, because they're the ones that continue to carry the message of life and hope.
Noelle Millier is Mi'kmaq from LCBookTok. This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. The last elder I want to introduce you to is Donna Augustine. She believes it is her responsibility to speak up for those old ones who can no longer speak for themselves. Her mission is to bring the remains of Wabanaki ancestors home to rest. The fierce LCBookTok First Nation elder tangles with the likes of the Smithsonian Institution and Harvard University. Over the years, Augustine says she has protected the burial sites of thousands of ancestors and reburied hundreds from many different tribes. Donna says this is what she came to this earth to do.
The late Albert Lightning, Buffalo Child, he was a medicine man from Hobim, Alberta. He was one of my most influential teachers, and he would say, it's just that some have got a bit disconnected from their sacred fire. So we all need to get connected now to our sacred fire. We all need to get connected to those teachings, those values of honesty, caring, sharing, and respect. And so now I'm sitting here, and I'm relying on the spirits of my ancestors to guide me, the ancestors of this land. I asked him for that guidance to bring the words. I am only a human being. I'm a physical human being. I have limitations. But our ancestors have no limitations. So because of that, I'm going to sing them this song. This is an ancient Mi'kmaq song, but actually it is also of the other tribes of the Wabanaki, the people of the Dawn. So I'm going to offer a little tobacco. With everything, we ask permission. Creator, spirits of four directions, and Mother Earth. The four beats on the drum are for the ones who went before us. And you might not know this, but as I was singing, I was asking for the help of all the ancestors that have helped to rebury, that have protected burial sites here at Midibinagia, the return of those ancestors. They came to me in 1977. I was pregnant with my second son, Bibugus, and they woke me up middle of the night, and they asked for my help. And a lot of work, but as a result, those ancestors have been put back into the ground. I've gone to many AFN conferences. Now we can't go because of COVID, but trying to implore to the chiefs across Canada to establish a law here in Canada, similar to the one in the United States, which is NAGPRA, Native American Graves Protection Repatriation Act Law. It was established in 1990, November of 1990, and I've been working on that law. When NAGPRA was started, all the museums had to provide summaries and inventories to the tribes of their holdings. For example, everything that was found in the state of Maine, or in other museums that are held from the state of Maine, they would send letters to the Wabanaki tribes. And so we work together. And then we come together, we make a request to those museums, and then they eventually return our ancestors. And then we have a reburial ceremony, very sacred reburial ceremony. We never disclose to the public where that is. We try to keep it hidden because we never want anyone to dig up our ancestors ever again. And so we're designated by the chiefs in writing to do this type of work. But we do this on behalf of all of our people. It's about those old ones that can no longer speak for themselves. When we do our ceremonies, when we raise our tobacco to pray, when we raise our pipes to pray, we ask the spirits of our ancestors for their help. We ask the Creator and the spirits of our ancestors. Now they, the ancestors, need our help. And this is how we help them. We need to bring them out of museums, out of institutions such as universities that use the remains of our ancestors as teaching tools. I've heard them refer to them as specimens in labs. They absolutely are not specimens in labs. They were somebody's child, somebody's grandfather, somebody's mother, somebody's father. And we respect our ancestors. You would not see Native people going behind a church and digging up a burial site to see what diet that they ate, why they had inner ear infections, the most famous line that they used to study our ancestors. Because we have respect for the ones that went before us. We respect everyone's dead. To me, no ancestor should ever be taken out of the ground and placed in a museum collecting dust. The ancestors at Jemseg, that highway, Trans-Canada Highway between Moncton and Fredericton. Some people might want to take all the credit for that, archaeologists, but no, that came spiritually. They were going to go through with that highway, and they told me that they had to do this because that highway was coming through. And I told them, you can stop that highway. They said, no, it's impossible. And I told them, nothing is impossible in my book. But I had to do it. I had to pray. We had to do ceremonies as instructed. And as a result, the dig was stopped, the bridge was moved, and Trans-Canada Highway rerouted. Can you imagine how much money that cost? And that strength of our ancestors, with only our sacred fire standing there 7 days and seven nights in the middle of the cold winter, you know, with our sacred fire and tobacco and our prayers, and that happened. I've protected many burial sites. I've protected thousands of ancestors at burial sites, and I've reburied hundreds of many tribes. This is my work. This is what I came to this earth to do as a physical human being.
Donna Augustine is from the Elsie Booktook First Nation. Many thanks to her and all the other elders for sharing their amazing and beautiful and inspirational and wise stories. That's all our time this week. Shout out to Mavonwe Davis, Jocelyn Elsden, Elaine Bateman, Michael Heenan, and Jennifer Sweet at CBC New Brunswick for the elder stories. This episode was produced by Aaron Knoll, Laura Bone-Stubing, Kim Kasher, and me, Rosanna Deerchild. I'm your favorite cousin, coming at you from Winnipeg in Treaty 1 territory. Kanaskinamitnawi, I go say.